Hi everyone, thank you for coming today and joining us at the Centre for History of Public Health seminar. My name is Daisy Hayden and I'm a research fellow at the Centre and I'll be chairing today's session. Just a reminder, the theme this term is behaviours, and I'm delighted to have Laura Cofield here with us today. Laura is a PhD student at the University of Sussex, and she's researching body hair removal. Today she's going to talk to us about that with regards to notions of hygiene and health. So without further ado,
thank you, Daisy. Thank you everyone for coming. I really appreciate it. So my research explores women's body hair removal and attitudes and behaviour in the 20th and 21st centuries. And I'm trying to accomplish this by investigating not only the prescriptive discourses around which body hair and hairlessness have been socially constructed, such as women's lifestyle magazines, pornography, feminist discourses, but also by looking at the experiences and life histories of women themselves to demonstrate this complex negotiation of these discourses and to expose how the ritual of depilation has become enmeshed in everyday life and in female identity formation. Today I want to talk to you specifically about how medical science, how their discursive production of pubic hair has helped and how this has helped to shape what it means to be hairless. Principally, I'll do this using as a case study the normalisation of pubic hair shaving as a practice in the pre-delivery preparation of childbirth from around the 1920s to the end of the century. As a case study, this demonstrates how cultural ideas and medical thinking about hygiene coalesced alongside increased clinical surveillance of the female body and its functions. As a result, pubic hair was reframed during the mid-20th century as a potential pathogen and site of disease. The study of the medicalisation of female body hair exemplifies how the theory and practice of medicine have continued to inform and be informed by temporal and cultural assumptions, which are deeply entrenched in hierarchies of gender, sex, race and class. I go on to examine how these medical constructs have shaped the way in which hair is presented in popular culture and vice versa. But before I continue, I thought it'd be useful to give you some context about my research and where it's situated in historical debates. This paper is an excerpt from my current doctoral research, as Daisy said. It's a project entitled Aftershave, A Cultural History of Pubic Hair Removal in 20th and 21st Century Britain. My initial interest was in examining what the contemporary trend of extensive pubic hair removal exposes about female sexual identity and women's changing relationship with their bodies in the post-feminist neoliberal age. As a result, the study can be seen to be building on the well-established tradition in feminist scholarship, which looks to expose the political in the personal and unmask the mechanisms of construction underlying gendered norms. Susan Brownmiller's proposal that, quote, hair indeed may be trivial, but it is central to the feminine definition, pretty much sums up my approach to this. And part of my methodology is to understand how this definition plays out in women's everyday lives, how it intersects with other experiences such as work, social relationships, and the constant building and rebuilding of an individual sense of self. This study is therefore very much situated in the discursive approaches of histories of the body and sexuality, but is also grounded in the methods of life history writing, which aims to understand broader economic, social, and cultural change through the analysis of intimate life stories. So female body hair as a historical subject has so far evaded in-depth scrutiny, although it has begun to be examined in other areas of scholarly work. Literary theorist Karen Lesnick-Oberstein's edited collection of essays entitled The Last Taboo examines the representation of female body hair within works of literature and visual cultures. An art historian Anne Hollander's discussion of the absence of hair as a signifier of beauty in historical works of art and sculpture both take a discursive approach to exploring constructions of hair. Various social psychological studies have been crucial in establishing through qualitative and quantitative surveying that there is evidence women and, to a lesser extent, men are paying more attention to pubic hair grooming in the 21st century. However, there lacks any thorough analysis of the specific economic, social and cultural conditions in which this change has taken place, and how constructions of hairlessness have been negotiated and removal behaviours have come to manifest in Britain specifically. I'm interested in examining if, how and why our grooming preferences and behaviours have changed, and understand how the emotional states of disgust, shame, pleasure and pain police rationale. So today, as I said, I'm focusing on the medicalisation of pubic hair in the 20th century, principally how the state of hairlessness has become so closely connected with good, hygienic, clean behaviour. How did the association between hairlessness and hygiene become the dominant paradigm within medicine and also, as we shall see, in popular culture? And what does this tell us about the way in which the female biological and physical form has been conceptualised through medical discourse? Ultimately, what I'm looking at is the ways medical thinking has assisted in sustaining the hairy woman in British culture as a figure of deviance and abhorrence. And this paper, to do this, is divided roughly chronologically into three sections. So the first section will, using the British Medical Journal and obstetric textbooks, map the discursive production of free delivery pubic hair shaving in Britain and its normalisation as a routine practice by the 1930s. The medical textbook as a historical source offers not only insight into the varying popularity of routine practices, but also captures how bodies were conceptualised, interpreted and presented at certain historical moments. And it shows how the roles of doctor, midwife and mother were imagined. I use primarily J. Whitridge Williams's textbook, which is entitled Obstetrics, a textbook for the use of students and practitioners, for this analysis. First published in the UK and in the USA in 1903, this is a particularly useful source as its numerous re-editions and re-rewrites throughout the century present a lucid trajectory of medical thinking regarding institutional antenatal care. The second section of this paper briefly details the circumstances leading up to the abandonment of pubic hair prepping, as it became known, as a routinised medical practice around the 1980s. Resistance came not only from within the medical establishment, which had begun to doubt the assumed link between hairlessness and asepsis, but also from external public groups and movements such as the Women's Liberation Movement and the National Childbirth Trust. Resistance also came more visibly from the pregnant women themselves and demonstrates an expanding sense of autonomy and consumer activism from patients during the 1970s and 80s. The third and final part of this paper examines why, despite the demise of the practice of shaving in medical care in the late 20th century, women in the 21st are still motivated to extensively remove their pubic hair for reasons of hygiene. Using personal accounts as well as examples from popular culture, I explore how hygiene still retains significance in the overall construction of female sexual identity and shows how feelings of shame and disgust still regulate the boundaries of appropriateness. So to my first section. So the social context of birth has been well established within both medical history and feminist scholarship. And I will not go into the details of the historiography here. Suffice to say that such work has demonstrated how the physiological process of pregnancy and childbirth transitioned from a predominantly private and individual experience to a medical event, one that was governed by expanding professional guidance and intervention over the century. This narrative exemplifies Foucault's notion of biopolitics, which he identified as, quote, the calculated management of life. This, he argued, manifested in two interlinking ways. Firstly, through the establishment of anatomopolitics, or the increasing discipline of the body and the optimization of its capabilities. Secondly, biopolitics manifested in the regulation of the population as a whole through increased intervention in and surveillance of biological processes and lifestyles, including birth, as well as sex and mortality. What I want to draw attention to is how the normalisation of pubic hair shaving fits into this narrative of optimisation and population control. But moreover, assimilates Foucault's notion of power with the gendered and class-based theories of pollution, purity and hygiene posited by Kristeva, Douglas Lupton, and more recently by Imogen Tyler in her work on the revolting subject. Tyler's theory of social abjection, as the, quote, spatializing politics of disgust, unquote, builds on the idea that disgust operates discursively and that, quote, images and signs of disgust become habituated through repetition, unquote. And this contributes to the stigmatization of certain objects and bodies and the social groups these belong to. Female body hair and facial hair can be seen as an example of this. The presence of hair can symbolize, amongst other things, dysfunction, insanity, militancy, aging. In other words, bodies which lack in the social capital according to neoliberal values. I propose that the examination of perineal shaving offers an insight into how mechanisms through which norms of abjection, such as body hair, are fabricated, operationalised and internalised. So the beginning of the 20th century is characterised by increased anxiety from medical and state authorities regarding the conditions of childbirth. Not only did maternal mortality rates remain consistently high, but the Boer War had exposed the low standard of health amongst the population, despite the introduction of numerous public health reforms in the late 19th century. Improving antenatal, intranatal and postnatal care became of national importance and responsibility once again after the loss of life experienced during the First World War. Parturition differs from all other physiological functions, stated Professor Johnston of midwifery in 1928, in that it is performed in the interests of race, while all others are performed in the interests of the individual only. The rediscovery of maternal mortality in 1919, a year in which the number of recorded childbirth deaths was greater than the previous 10, forced practitioners to reflect on the insufficiency of existing preventative measures of puerperal infection. So the importance of asepsis and antiseptic procedures had long been established as a result of the work of Semmelweis, amongst others, but debate ensued within the medical British medical establishment in the interwar period concerning whether or not these measures were being adhered to and who or what was to blame for the persistently high number of deaths of women from puerperal sepsis. Speculative opinions and medical research were recorded and discussed in the British Medical Journal, with two schools of thought emerging. The first considered the causes of maternal infection as exogenous, or the result of external origin, probably due to poor housing and sanitary conditions. The second school subscribed to the notion of autogenetic or self-generated causes, which the natural disposition of the female reproductive system produced. This led to speculation about, as one obstetrician described in 1921, the, quote, uterine inefficiency, which rendered it so liable to infection. Both of these schools of thought contributed to a new modern doctrine based upon preventative and reparative obstetrics. Natural childbirth was reframed not just as inefficient, but also as hazardous. Nature has made the mistake of placing the birth area almost in the middle of this danger zone, Dr. Victor Bonney was quoted to have said in 1921. The implication was that nature had failed in creating the optimal conditions for childbirth, and that relying on nature was an outdated and inefficient course of action for practitioners to take. As a result, physicians in the BMJ called for a new frame of mind towards labour, and to treat it with the same care and precaution as if it were a surgical procedure. This entailed preparing and treating the area of the vulva as if it was a site of potential infection. Practitioners' tools and clothing were to be sterilised accordingly, and although examination and general supervision were to be increased, any contact with the exposed area was to be minimal in order to maintain sterility. This new surgical approach to childbirth initiated a change not just in behaviour but in the use of language in reference to the external genitalia. This differed depending on the physician's interpretation of whether the area was in danger of infection or constituted the danger itself. The hair around the pubis was recognised by physicians as an inherent threat to asepsis. Blair Bell, for example, suggested a piece of unpurified vulval skin and hair placed in the uterus would probably be far more deadly than a spoonful of faeces. Moreover, faeces looks infective, whereas the vulva does not, and the latter therefore constitutes a danger too often unsuspected. The severity of such contamination was articulated through an almost militaristic attitude to intervention, illustrated in Munro Kerr's assertion that the field of operation in the case of the parturient receives but perfunctory attention, and yet it is a most septic area. The hair of the pubis and the folds of the vulva teem with pyogenic organisms, constantly added to from the bowel, which is in the immediate vicinity. Other physicians, such as obstetrician G.W. Theobald of Mary Abbott's Hospital, Kensington, emphasise the vulnerability of the site to external infection and the importance of maintaining its purity. Theobald describes his approach as a, quote, modified Garden of Eden approach to delivery, unquote, which involved as little interference with the vaginal opening and area as possible. This sense of veneration infers not only the religious underpinnings of which constructions of female sex and gender continue to be conceived, but in contrast to the previous attitudes, depicted the natural state of the vagina as uncorrupted, blemished, and pure. So what does this all mean? It has been argued that the pregnant body holds a problematic status within society. Tyler explains, quote, on the one hand, pregnancy has been constructed as sacred, on the other, indelibly marked by sex. Pregnant women disrupt traditional constructions of ideal femininity as virtuous by embodying the consequences of sexual activity. It is through the lens of this virgin whore dichotomy that we can analyse the language of the new modern doctrine to childbirth. This almost combative language of, quote, the danger zone and the field of operation was underlined with a desire to reclaim control and police the boundaries of female sexual identity in the interwar period. It is worth noting that historians of women's leisure, such as Langhammer and Zwinager Bardzielowska, have demonstrated that this was also an era in which women were increasingly visible in the public sphere and allowed to participate in an expanding repertoire of previously male-dominated activities, thus arguably increasing the need to otherwise control the distinctions between the sexes. So the Williams Obstetrics textbook series illustrates how significant this change in language and practice was. As early as 1903, Williams made reference to the management of pubic hair as part of the preparation for vaginal examination during the first stages of labour. As part of his instructions, he stipulated, the vulva and the inner surfaces of the thigh are then thoroughly washed with soap and hot water, particular attention being paid to the regions around the anus and the clitoris. If the pubic hairs are very long, they should be cut short with scissors or shaved. Such guidance implies that practitioner subjectivity and personal preference were the main criteria underlying removal practice, and suggests that variation was probably common in the early 20th century. This was further maintained in the third edition, published in 1912, which again relied on personal judgment as the determining factor, stating, quote, to prepare the patient for vaginal examination, place her upon a douche pan and cut the pubic hairs if necessary. The accompanying illustration seen here elucidates further how the normal conduct of childbirth should be visualised. Hair is evident on top of the mons pubis, but is distinctly absent from the patient's labia and around the anus, the areas perceived by Bonnie, if we remember, as the danger zone. Also of note, this is the only part of the patient we can see. The rest of her body covered in sheets demonstrates the emphasis on the isolation of the perineal field as a preventative strategy, but also, as feminist scholarship has shown, risking the disappearance of the patient and her emotional well-being in the process. So further editions maintain this instructive narrative until the seventh edition was published in 1936. The change in tone is discernible not only in the more explicit guidance on hygienic practice in antenatal care in both hospital and home, but also in the clearer listed designation of tasks between obstetrical nurse or midwife and the doctor. There are 9 listed instructions for midwives to complete at the time of labour. After notifying the doctor, preparing the room, and giving the patient a warm sponge bath and soap-suds enema, the guidance reads, quote, to prepare for vaginal examination, place the patient upon the douche pan and shave the external genital and pubic region. Then wash the genitalia thoroughly from above downwards towards the anus with soap and warm water, taking care that the soap suds and rinsings do not come into contact with the vaginal opening. The doctor should take care of the rest of the cleansing. This call for greater precision and meticulous practice is characteristic of the new modern doctrine of the surgical approach to childbirth outlined previously. In the section on physicians' preparations for labour, the three principles of infection prevention, of which we are now familiar, were stringently reiterated. Number one, prevention of potential infecting organisms from exogenous sources being deposited on the external genitals or adjacent area. Number two, sterilisation of the perineal field in order to prevent migration, transportation or growth organisms from this field into the vagina. And number three, prevention of the existing bacterial flora in the vagina from being carried into the uterus. This shift in tone in William's obstetrics from the 1936 edition onwards is suggestive of a widespread and unanimous acceptance of shaving within the medical establishment. Medical historian Edward Shorter also suggests that at this time there was also a transformation in the antenatal practice in which more attention was given over to perinatology, which prioritised the care and delivery of the infant over the health and well-being of the mother. Subsequent editions of William's obstetrics continued to advocate pubic hair shaving for the next five decades. It is only in the 1980 edition that a more reserved approach becomes noticeable. It was stated, quote, in many hospitals, shaving or clipping is the practice. The next part of this paper will go into more detail about how and why this decline came about. So I recognise that in the structuring of this paper, it implies that resistance to pre-delivery shaving only started to emerge in the latter half of the 20th century. And to confess, it has been much harder to find the voices of resistance pre-1970s in the historical record. Articles in the BMJ do infer that there was opposition to the procedure when it was first established. For example, Dr. Munro Kerr, who was Professor of Obstetrics and Gynaecology at Glasgow University, argued in 1926 that, quote, it has been urged that women would object to such preparations. I am perfectly certain that if it was impressed on all parturient women that this detail is necessary, few would object. Shorter corroborates this notion of a mellowing of resistance from the 1930s onwards, as he suggests mothers became more accepting of and compliant with the authority of medical experts, persuaded that the health of the infant took precedence and, quote, would best come from a non-septic birth canal, unquote. It is also suggested that another reason for the waning of objection from patients was the technological improvements made to the safety razor, which made it increasingly convenient to use. Having said this, I'm inclined to support Anne Oakley's claim that, quote, consumer dissatisfaction with antenatal care has always existed, but the healthcare and wider political climate of the 60s and 70s has allowed the dissatisfaction an organisational voice of its own, unquote. It is this growing visibility of discontent in the later 20th century that I will now focus upon. So by the mid-1960s, obstetricians began to question the practice of shaving, illustrated by the publication in Obstetrics and Gynaecology Journal of two articles. Firstly, Burchill's pre-delivery removal of pubic hair in 1964, and Cantor, Rembert, Tabio and Buchanan's value of shaving the pudendal perineal area in delivery preparation in 1965. The question, is it necessary, posed by Burchill, indicates a growing scepticism of the complex and strict preparation of birth imposed by obstetricians of the 1920s. By the 1980s, the aseptic rituals of surgical intervention were more explicitly being abandoned, including the surgical scrub, as well as shaving, disinfecting, draping, and also preparing of the bowel, replaced by a more simplified model of preparation. Perineal shaving was also being queried in terms of the physical and psychological impact it was having on the mother in her experience of childbirth. The publication of M. Romney's 1980 study entitled Pre-Delivery Shaving and Unjustified Assault? Was influential in that it demonstrated through an investigation of 693 patients that, quote, shaving did not affect the incidence of infection, unquote, and in addition for the first time surveyed their opinions, concluding that 98% of the women in the study, quote, were disappointed that they were shaved due to the resulting discomfort it produced. The conclusion read, We find no evidence to support the current and widespread practice of perineal shaving. It increases the patient discomfort without reducing infection or improving health. We believe that perineal shaving is an unjustified assault and should be abandoned. The significance of this investigation was identified by Judith Scott, antenatal teacher and member of the National Childbirth Trust. In 1982, she wrote to Romney about the study, asking for more information in order for antenatal teachers to share with expectant parents. This demonstrates a turning point in the relationship between mothers and midwives, evidenced further in the inaugural speech of Sue Sadler, president of the British Royal College of Midwives in 1988. She stated, quote, "I can see the development in the trust from the telling them how to do it style to the enabling them to have the knowledge and confidence to find their own way of doing it style," unquote. She proceeded to suggest how the role of the expert should be to empower the parent and bestow a sense of control over their own lives. This illustrates the alteration in consciousness of both medical practitioners and patients in the 1980s. Characterised by Oakley as a consumer revolt, it is argued that the role of the patient transformed from passive recipient to consumer activist, encouraged by new cultures of citizenship and as a result of better education. Oakley's work itself, first published in 1984, and detailing how the medical profession had captured the womb, was part of this dialogue, acknowledging the sense of powerlessness medicalisation of childbirth had caused women. Conversely, however, Romney's 1980 investigation highlighted the continued support of shaving from midwives who took part in the study, 90% of whom supported perineal shaving. This was expanded in my own oral history research. I interviewed Carol, a retired midwife, who, having trained in the North of England in the early 1970s, spoke very positively about prepping. She remarked of the time, they, as in the mothers, used to come and say, "Oh, it feels cleaner, I feel much cleaner," sort of thing, and didn't seem to object to it at all. "I was really good at shaving, I can tell you, and I used to say to them, don't worry about this, because I'm very good at it, you know, in case they thought I was going to cut. I would say, yes, I would rather be shaved, I'll be honest, I would now, you know." Although Carol remained nostalgic in her memories of prepping, she also noted how the decline of the practice of shaving was connected to changes in the profession more generally, echoing the sentiment of the NCT in recognising the needs of mothers as well as infants. She said, "Nobody wants to be put up in a lithotomy, you know, with the legs up. Nobody wants that. They've got much nicer ones now, but I think the staff are more nicer to people now, so I think it makes it easier. You know, not like, come in here and do what you're told, than this sort of thing. I think it's all changed now for the better, you know, where you're just giving her a service and hopefully she'll come back again if she wants to. You know, if she wants to." The undesirable experience of the lithotomy, which Carol recalls, is more fully detailed by journalist and broadcaster Jenny Murray in her testimony for the Sisterhood and After Feminist Oral History Project, based at the British Library. In her reflections on the challenging relationship she had with her mother, Murray pointed to her birth as one of the pivotal moments which established an ongoing tension between them. She said, "I was a dreadful disappointment. She would have actually been much better off if she stayed at home and had the local midwife come in, much better off. But, you know, we, the NHS, the hospital, this was the right place to go. And they lay her on, they shaved her, they gave her an enema, they lay her on her back in the bed with her legs in the air and left her on her own. And she was in labour for 24 hours and came very close to dying, apparently. I have been told this story so many times, I can't tell you." In this account, the act of shaving, situated alongside the other routine NHS practices, such as the use of an enema, the prohibition of visitors, and the immobilisation of the mother on her back, is depicted as a state of vulnerability and exposure. Murray rationalises that at this time it was considered, quote, "the right place to go," which demonstrates not only that the success of the medical establishment in garnering complete medical jurisdiction over childbirth, but its success in convincing patients that such measures were necessary and ethical. It remained only after the event that expertise were questioned. Romney's research and Murray's personal account illustrate two reasons behind a growing resistance to pubic shaving from patients themselves. Firstly, the painful itching and discomfort that shaving caused, and secondly, the emotional trauma that accompanied this. The political significance of these feelings were championed and explicated by women's health activists within the women's liberation movement in the 70s and 80s. The mainstream feminist magazine Spare Rib popularised these experiences further, as the issues surrounding childbirth and the medical intervention took prominence in the publication, mainly between the 1978 and 89. Perineal shaving took an almost symbolic status. It represented all that was wrong in the medical model of antenatal care, the unnecessary and deceptive measures of childbirth management, the disregard for women's psychological well-being, and the lack of autonomy over their own bodies. Articles such as birth, home or hospital, and no such thing as pain, focused upon the personal experience of mothers in hospitals to illustrate this. Testimonies recalled, for example, despite your protests, you are shaved and given an enema, during which your companion is made to leave the room, which upsets you. Another woman remembered, stripped, shaven and duly humiliated, I had a prophetic glimpse of the horrors which awaited me. And finally, I expected the pain. What I wasn't prepared for was the indignity of the experience. The trauma experienced by women in the process of giving birth formed part of a greater politicisation of control over women's bodies, initiated by feminism's second wave. This was to be achieved not only through reform, but by self-education. The publication Our Bodies Ourselves embodied this goal. A text dedicated to, quote, finding out about ourselves. This was argued to be most crucial when it came to the taboo subjects of reproduction and sex. The rhetoric mirrors the new consumer consciousness of parents and suggests women were eager to discover alternatives to the medical model. On the subject of hospital policy regarding the prepping of pubic hair, the second edition of Our Bodies stated, this is totally unnecessary. It is just one part of the male medical ritual of depolluting, purifying women. Prepping desexes us, makes us look like little girls again. Doctors believe that pubic hair contains germs and prepping decreases the risk of infection. In fact, prepping increases the risk of infection, which surface skin cells, when surface skin cells are scraped off, and sometimes raises nicked skin. Since the last edition of this book, many hospitals have dropped the procedure, but it is still routine in some hospitals. In their rejection of the presumed link between hygiene and hairlessness, feminist activists exposed the gendered underpinnings of shaving. They argued it was bound up in Western cultural constructions of the chaotic nature of the female reproductive organs, which needed to be socially refined. Their claim that, quote, prepping desexes us, unquote, was suggestive of society's persistent anxiety over female sexual impulses and sexual identity as a whole. Pubic hair was a symbol of mature, fertile womanhood. It was no coincidence, they argued, that medicine had also demarcated its pathological risk. For my final section, I want to briefly explore how, in the last 40 years, the idea that pubic hair removal desexes women has been turned on its head. Representations of hairlessness in mainstream porn and television programmes such as Sex and the City now explicitly link sexual performativity for women with being hairless. Even more interesting is how discourses of hygiene still manifest in this hair-sex paradigm. Oh, I'm not ready. According to Mintel Consumer Survey Report in 2014, and academic psychological research such as Tigerman and Hodgson's 2008 study, hygiene or the feeling of being clean has been cited by younger women especially as one of the predominant motivations for extensive pubic hair removal. Now by extensive I mean not just around the bikini line, as it's known, but extensive removal on the mons pubis and complete removal from the vulva to the anus. This is despite physicians such as Dr. Emily Gibson calling out in the popular press in 2012 for an end to extensive pubic hair removal, specifically because it has been shown that methods such as waxing and shaving were more likely to increase the risk of infection and health problems rather than improve personal hygiene. So what does this tell us as historians? Well, to explore this, I draw upon the musings of Brazilian wax creator and co-owner of the Jesus de Salon in New York, Janaea Padilla. In her co-authored memoir and beauty self-help book entitled Brazilian Sexy, Secrets to Living a Gorgeous and Confident Life, which was first published in 2010, its rhetoric is grounded in post-feminist sensibility. Its focus is on individualism, choice and empowerment. It articulates a marked sexualisation of culture with an emphasis on consumerism and a preoccupation with the body as the key to feminine subjectification. She writes, quote, "More than anything, I am known as the woman who invented the Brazilian wax. I'm very proud of that because I think the Brazilian wax gives women more confidence and makes them sexier, cleaner, and more self-assured," unquote. Padilla goes into great detail about the physical and psychological transformative properties of the Brazilian wax, echoing the dominance of the makeover narrative in post-feminist media culture. She says, first of all, it's a lot more sanitary because you can just wash that area and get it really clean. Elsewhere, she says, it makes them, the clients, feel so much confident. It's a funny thing. No one knows you've done it and yet you feel so much more sure of yourself. And finally, the Brazilian is great for all the reasons I told you, but here's the best part. The Brazilian makes sex so much better because there is nothing between you and your man. Whether he is just stroking you or you are having intercourse, the sensation is heightened. For Padilla, hairlessness and cleanliness were still intimately connected with ideas about female sexual identity and behaviour. For her, the external appearance of hygiene was deeply connected to internal psychological stability and wholesomeness. And previously, I argued that the pregnant body lies at the fault lines of sex, between the sacred and the defiled. Discourses of hygiene were a way in which this was policed. In an era where the purposes of sex have been expanded from procreative and as an expression of love to include sex simply as an act of pleasure, I argue this contradictory status is now embodied by the 21st century sexually active woman, the Brazilian wax becoming emblematic of this Madonna whore distinction. Again, discourses of hygiene regulate potentially transgressive female sexuality and toxic sexual practices, which sex for the simple reason of pleasure denotes. I want to return to the figure of the pregnant body in my final analysis of pubic hairlessness in the 21st century, using the experiences of one of my oral history participants. In her late 20s, Emily had just 6 months previously given birth to her first child. Her experiences suggest that there have been significant changes in how pregnancy and labour are now managed by medical professionals. Emily was allowed to have a water birth at home in the presence of her husband and midwife. She rejected using antenatal methods and instead practiced the hypnobirthing breathing technique. Interestingly, although she remembers it as a happy occasion, Emily talked about it as one of the most recent times in which she felt extremely conscious and anxious about her body hair. She described, "I think the most recent one, as in example of feeling anxious, is the birth of my daughter, because I couldn't reach to like shave my pubic area or couldn't reach to do my legs. And I had been saying all the way through my pregnancy, as soon as I feel the first contraction, I'm going to really make the real effort. And it didn't happen. And I didn't think about it in the birth, thankfully. But as soon as she was out and I wanted to apologise to the midwife because of my hair. I remember that thought. And I think I even did say it. I think I apologised, like, I'm so sorry about my hair. Like, what are you doing? And that's like tainted the experience in a way, because I think, why were you apologising? You've just been through childbirth of all things." This experience demonstrates a direct contrast with that depicted in the personal accounts in Spare Rib, in that the reasons for feeling shame are reversed. Instead of feeling humiliated because of having to be shaved by the midwife, Emily's sense of humiliation came from having the midwife see her unshaved. This may seem bizarre, but I suggest it shows hairlessness is still enforced, but now through self-regulation rather than explicit instruction. This epitomises Foucault's notion of the internalisation of the gaze. But this isn't to say that Emily doesn't subsequently at least recognise and question this. Instead, she finds herself having to negotiate a double bind of guilt. Guilt in not removing her hair, and then subsequently a guilt for wanting to remove the hair in the first place. A negotiation which I explore more explicitly in another chapter on feminism's influence on hair removal behaviours. So to summarise, in this talk I have tried to show how the perineal shave was part of the implementation of biopolitics in the 20th century. Its aim was to facilitate improvement to the national rate of maternal mortality by optimising the perceivably inefficient process of labour. Thus, the practice became symbolic of the ever-expanding medical jurisdiction over the pregnant body. Pubic hair was pathologised in that it became characterised as a carrier of disease and detrimental to the health of child and mother. What I think this study demonstrates is the extent to which discourses of hygiene constructed around pubic hair illustrate the anxiety about the need to maintain cleanliness of sex, both the act and the sexual identity. I've argued that hairlessness and cleanliness have been and still are intimately connected with ideas about sexual identity and potentially toxic behaviours. Extensive pubic hair removal and the birth of the Brazilian wax in the 21st century exposes this crossover between the theoretical work on pollution and disgust as a marker of social distinction and the reframing of femininity and female sexuality in the context of the post-epidemic AIDS, post-feminist era of police sexuality. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura. Does anybody have any questions?
So a lot of your talk was about women in Britain.